Cheers.
All right.
We have a little captain in us this evening.
Oh, is that what it is?
Yeah.
Okay.
Well,
right, yeah.
And,
spicy.
And one of Schlegel's suggestions. What was it? Bacardi. Yes.
All right. Yes,
because it is episode 20 of RPG Afterglow,
okay,
where the dice get rolled, the story gets told, and we ponder the significance. I'm Jake.
And I'm Mako.
We now are in our first full-fledged week of the Floating Isles. We kind of spent last session getting there, right?
Yeah, I would say so.
I mean, we had just gotten there, but we are still kind of getting there as far as the whole immersion thing goes.
Yeah, I would say that first island was still very much like the intro.
Yeah.
You know, it was like going through the first room.
Because there was a map initially given to us of, I don't know, at first glance here, it looks like a couple dozen little islands.
Mm-hmm.
So in any good storytelling sense, you're not going to get to the big island right away.
No.
So that was, yeah, definitely set up to be kind of like a here, you're kind of getting a bigger picture, kind of some exposition going on, an introduction. And now here we are kind of hitting a stride. And it definitely was an action-packed thing. I know that you and I had kind of talked between sessions about just kind of that harsh reality of time in the real world.
Right.
And for us, we play once a week. We play from 6 o'clock to 10 o'clock, ideally. But lately, we've been kind of starting a little later. And lately, we've been consistently playing with a full party, i.e. 5 players, when we're used to 4. We've also been kind of being more sociable than focused.
Right.
And we kind of realized that those 3 factors combined, starting late, having a lot of people, and not being all that focused, at least between you and I in our conversations, we're kind of like, we can get more out of our money here.
Well, and, you know, the whole thing is it's hard to pace very open-ended kind of things. If we're in the woods, it's hard to pace that. When we're in town, it's hard to pace that when you have 5
You want to give freedom, but you don't want to guide, but you don't want to let it get too out of control.
Right. So, I mean, I think it's very hard to pace where this, you know, this week, the incidents and the things that were happening are far more structured.
Right.
And I would say structured in the sense of it was like a dungeon.
Right.
It was like a delve. You could definitely say it was
Events that were waiting for us.
Right.
Whereas, you know, in the past, it was kind of like you're there exploring, you're checking stuff out, and it is a very delicate balance between giving your players freedom to kind of do what they would, but still trying to have this forward direction without trying to guide where they would go when there's so many possibilities. But I think it was beneficial to this last session that we just had for us to have voice to Wolfie, our DM, because that kind of seemed the diplomatic way to go in regards to at least this whole awareness of we could be using our time better. Mm-hmm. And part of me initially was like, before we start, I just want to say something to the table, but I kind of kept myself in check and decided to talk to Wolfie ahead of time and say, hey, this is what I'm thinking. I was talking to Mako and we're kind of thinking this. What are your thoughts? How should we address it? Is it worth addressing? At least to bring it up to the DM who's running it. He's the one that's more or less responsible for our good time every time we sit down at the table. So at least to make it known, to establish that, all right, here's where we're at. We're kind of wanting to bring it to this next level.
And being a DM, if your players are coming up to you and voicing complaints, don't become offended. Don't become, you know, hostile to it. Listen to what they have to say because, you know, a lot of it is very easy fixes, or it's just like, what, you know, they're looking for something and you're not being controlled if you give them some leeway with it. They're pointing out what they want out of the experience. And, you know, it is, you're the DM, you are ultimately the one who is putting the most work in, but, you know.
It only matters so much as what your players get out of it.
Exactly. If your players aren't enjoying what's happening, you need to listen to what is being set.
But then on the flip side, I think as a player, you should be aware of the work and the effort and the, at least ideally, the goal for what the DM is putting all this work towards.
Yeah.
When you voice a quote unquote complaint, don't just focus on that. Whenever there's an issue, make sure you also provide a solution or at least what you want out of this issue.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. You know, it's like, because you were going to first do it at a table, and that's putting everyone in a really awkward situation.
And catching the DM off guard and catching everyone off guard, and people are sitting there going, oh, is she talking about me? Right. You know, I made a lot of jokes last week, you know, blah, blah, blah.
And so, I mean, it's a far more respectful thing to pull them aside at the beginning and just say, hey, this is what I'm experiencing, this is what I'm feeling. And I think the worst thing is to hold those grudges inside, because it starts to just really seep in and ruin your two.
Because then all of a sudden, in the thick of playing, it'll come out and then totally derail the whole experience.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I mean, and when I was talking to Wolfgang about just this whole aspect of, sure, there's an unavoidable reality of having having five players at the table, because it cuts out that much more time out of everybody else, because you want to give that fifth player their equal share too. But I think we can buckle down and focus to make it all work for everybody. And even in saying that, just that much kind of felt a little attacky from my point of view. You know what I mean? Like,
well, you're so sensitive.
Well, but then I guess in order to like bring it to what I was talking about, you know, bringing a solution or meeting the DM halfway. Mm-hmm. It's this issue of getting more bang for our hourly buck. I mean, just because you and I had the conversation and you had signed the dotted line on this issue, and I was speaking to Wolfgang while you and Schlegel were talking upstairs before we started.
Yeah.
I said, you know, while these things are here, and I don't want to put all this on you, like all of a sudden you need to make more things happen, DM. All right. That I also followed it up with, hey, if there's anything we can do, at least Mako and I, we are here to help you too.
Yeah.
As much as we're talking about these things, I'm equally at fault of kind of getting carried away and finding something and latching onto it and thinking it's funny to go ahead and do some spell-like ability and be a gnome, blah, 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 and it kind of derails things.
It did. We hit the ground running, and we were at a good spot because we were right at the scuttled ship.
We approached what is basically a floating delve.
Well, it's a half-sunken ship.
Right? Yeah.
And we took a skiff over. We approached this half-sunken ship.
And Wolfie put a lot of work into our skiff, I remember. He drew out, yeah, it was our dry erase sponge for our game board.
Yeah.
We all conveniently fit on it, but yeah. It's like, I'm on a dirty skiff.
Yeah.
This thing's covered in black marker.
I'm on a sponge. I think it was Tobias jumped out first.
And then you immediately decided to step out, but with the aid of your flying.
I flew.
Yes.
I don't go in water. That's silly.
Me neither.
You, and then Magnus got out and then was started heading up, and then you decided to go onto the sunken part of it.
Right. So the immediate response was all of us step out. You step out into air because you can fly. Magnus is there on the ship. Tobias is there on the ship. I'm there on the ship, and Taro stays on the skiff.
Yeah, right, yeah. I flew all the way to the top and searched some bodies, found that they were killed by magic and arrows. And I found a scroll case with a couple of scrolls in it, but they were slightly burned. I think
there was an icon on there, wasn't there?
Yeah.
A symbol?
Shandar, the god of travel and trade. And I rolled really good on that, by the way. I have knowledge religion, and I rolled a 20. I was rocking some 20s right away. It was great. But Tobias was searching other bodies. I don't know if he really discovered much of anything. I can't really remember. It wasn't very poignant.
Taro, from his point of view on the skiff, saw a body floating out just off of the ship kind of sink down. Yeah. And there was initial paranoia of, did it sink because it was dead? Or did something drag it under?
Yeah, and then you went underwater.
Right, because if you imagine this wrecked ship, it's kind of at an angle where the front half is above water. The other half is down underneath the surface of the water.
Yeah.
So when we all step out kind of at this halfway point of submersion, I decide to expand our peripheral by going into the part underwater when everyone else goes to that part above water. Mm-hmm. You know, this is no new situation, I suppose, when everyone's going in that direction that is more sensical.
Yeah.
And not only keeps the party together, but is at least conceivably safer. But I think, well, what if I go under there and find something important? So I start feeding myself along, and I'm walking along the railing and going underwater, and Magnus notices where I went, and in typical fashion, Magnus is keeping an eye on me.
It was pretty much at that point that we reckoned there was a monster that came up out of the water.
Right. It's one of these, at least as a player, I think is kind of a delicate balance of, you come to this ship, there's been a massacre, we're kind of checking things out. Everything in my role-playing intuition is saying there's a combat waiting, and it's going to be at any moment that we're going to roll initiative. But in that meantime, I have certain role-playing impulses that are in exact opposition to strategically setting myself up for that inevitable combat. And so, at least for me, here I am 10 feet underwater, having rifled along the railing here, and then this huge squid tentacled thing comes out and attacks us.
It was a squid.
Yeah.
We all failed our knowledge check, but everyone knew it was a squid.
Megan was desperately wanting it to be a kraken, because she just really liked to say, release the kraken!
Yeah, but she doesn't really understand how bad a kraken would be.
At least, yeah, in Pathfinder. I mean, like, kraken is obviously it's a character beyond Pathfinder.
Right.
It's a legendary monster. Just like Loch Ness Monster or anything else.
I'm pretty certain kraken is in the...
No, it's there.
Yeah, it's there.
But it's also elsewhere in other folk, you know, in other mythic tales.
It's at least a monster that 20th level creatures will deal with. It's highly dangerous.
If you want to fight that thing and survive, you need to be able to rely on the fact that your ship will get crumbled by it.
Yeah.
And still be able to do your thing.
Right.
Which we're not at 7th level characters.
So my spell fly is still on.
Yeah. So you're in the place that Violet likes to be.
In the air, far away from combat. Good safe place.
First attacked Tobias, if I recall.
Yeah. Tobias was the main target, and it really did a lot of damage to him.
Yeah. Like, even though it wasn't a Kraken, it still managed to do a shit ton of damage.
I think it did like 50 hit points. Or close to that, which really mowed him down through his hit points.
Yeah, and he was kind of on, if you imagine the ship has its main deck kind of around the perimeter, and then on the inside there was another deck 10 feet up.
Mm-hmm.
So he was on the lower deck facing the creature, and on that same side I was going underwater, and Magnus had just gone in after me.
Yeah.
So it clocks Tobias a bunch, and then it proceeds to attack Magnus with its tentacles, and what Magnus found, it also had a beak attack.
Yeah. So I got into the air, I cast Lightning Bolt down on it.
Yep. And I was rather pleasantly surprised to find that your Lightning Bolt attack didn't cause... I mean, I've never looked into Lightning Bolt in the water, I don't even know if they have rules, but part of my paranoia was like, you throw electricity into a body of water and I'm in it, I might take damage too, like a splash damage equivalent or something.
Conducting, but there's nothing that describes that, so I think...
And I was kind of, 20 feet away anyway, so I guess we're okay.
But in the air I stayed. Tobias did not make the next round. He tried to cast a spell on himself and concentrate. That failed, and he took another hit and fell.
And this is massive damage.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, as much as we were talking about that whole level of you're getting in higher levels and things should be more heroic and we're more heroic and look how badass we are, suddenly there's this monster that's dealing these numbers that we've never heard of,
mm-hmm,
with all these tentacles, a number of attacks that we've never seen.
And Taro was on the boat and he was having difficulty just getting some crossbow bolts out.
Because the only thing that was above the surface of the water were these tentacles.
And he kept almost dropping his crossbow.
Yeah.
So
saving against the critical fail.
Yeah. Yeah. But while you were dealing with stuff underwater, surprisingly to me, a blue hammer appeared and hit me back to the boat like a croquet mallet.
Yeah. I mean, Wolfie brought it back to that time where Tobias appeared outside of our house when Steve had missed a session.
Yeah.
And it was just this whole divine intervention hammer, clink, boom, there you are, back in action. Yep. But it happened to you this time.
Yep. And it was a voice saying, save your friend. So I got there and I fed him some heal potions, and you...
I was forced into a scenario of, I guess my thoughts come to The Rock, the movie with Nicolas Cage and Sean Connery, and Sean Connery's, hold on, if you must never hesitate. And that there was a pivotal point in retrospect where I'm still underwater, Magnus is 5 or 10 feet to my right, further up the slope. All I want to do at that point is get above the surface of the water. But I realize that this squid has been attacking Magnus, and from where I'm at, it could easily attack me too. So I see my limited movement underwater, and I see Magnus in my direct path to get above water, that I'm going to hold my action until Magnus gets out of the way so that I can get up out of the murky muck and the disadvantage of being underwater, but I'm still within range of its attacks. So I choose in something that would disappoint Sean Connery's character in The Rock, where I hesitate and I decide to spend one of my rounds in combat in this whole wake, hiding, staying underwater, buckling down, hoping that the focus will be on something else other than me, because I'm helpless. Underwater, my movement in general is crap. And underwater, it's even worse. And it depends on these swim rolls, which I don't have. I declare that I'm hiding, I roll my hide, it doesn't work, and suddenly I'm the brunt of a number of attacks too. So I'm able to drink a potion underwater, as we all learned together, and I think that inevitably contributed to the ending of this combat, where I was able to drink my thorn body extract, not having the time to fully buff myself. If I suffer damage, at least it will suffer damage too. And it was like 1d6 plus my level, which is 7, so it was something to contribute, where then, soon thereafter, in inky blackness response, it shoots the cloud, runs off.
Yeah, and you know, and to get to Taro was shooting arrows, and then finally Taro decided to use up some of the magical ammunition that he has. And you know, and this is one of the things that's, you know, tough about an archer, is that you have this magical ammunition and you want to use it at prime times. But like potions, like anything else, if your DM gives you stuff, I think the wisest thing to do is use them. Saving on and holding on to these things, unless you have a very, like, like a conservative DM, you'll get more stuff.
Yeah.
You know, so.
And it will only fuel your disappointment when you sit on it for 8 or 10 sessions. And then finally use it and you miss.
Right. Use that
ammunition. Use it or lose it.
Yeah, use that ammunition. So, and so Tara did finally fire a lightning and a fire one at the squid as well. I do believe made contact on it. And, you know, and the whole thing is even shooting into the water, I mean, it just had cover. So there's just an opportunity of missing, which, you know, you gotta, in a combat, you gotta take those gambles and say, okay, I'm gonna get this opportunity of missing. Still fire into it.
Because dice rolling is all about confidence.
Right, exactly. Getting back to it, I did resuscitate...
Tobias.
And for doing that, I did get a divine...
Fourth level spell.
A favor from... Yeah, I got a divine favor from his goddess, Kriya, and I got a fourth level spell, which was...
Of your choosing.
Of my choosing, which is pretty intense.
That, I guess, gives us reason to step back and at least look at it immediately, as it struck me, at least as a player at the table. I don't think any of us realized that Tobias was dead.
Well, and when Tobias did come around, he did say, I was dead.
Yeah. I'm below zero, and I have to do stabilization rolls to stabilize and then get healed and be back to normal. He was beyond his constitution score.
Yeah.
He was, for all intents and purposes, dead.
Right.
As he shared that note with Wolfgang, because we still maintain that whole secrecy of when you go under zero, don't let the table know, let the DM know, roll even if you've stabilized to make it look like you're still trying to, you know, because us as adventurers, seeing somebody fallen from 10 feet away or for however far away we are, we don't know if they're stabilized. We don't know if they need our immediate help. But I do remember Schlegel writing a note and passing it to Wolfgang, and Wolfie doing some like, holy shit laugh. Whatever that meant, turns out that's what it meant.
So, but what we did experience, we experienced a couple of things in this combat.
Yeah.
And the first one being is...
The hand of God. The Deus Ex Machina.
Yes.
And, as it were. And that's a very tender subject.
Or it's a tender thing for a GM to do.
Yes.
You don't want to overuse it, because then...
You should always ask yourself, why?
Why?
And in this particular instance, I thought the execution was creative, but I thought the reasoning was justified, too.
Yeah.
I mean, my premise was that, sure, this was an epic monster, but it was kind of just an encounter along the path of something greater, i.e. these whole floating isles thing.
Yeah.
And for Tobias to be taken out that way, right when we're on our second session of these isles, is kind of a ripoff for Tobias as a character.
Yeah.
If you're looking at it from a narrative point of view, take it back to the first major death of the first major D&D experience, i.e. Lord of the Rings and Boromir going out. It's like there was many narrative points for the DM to take out that character there and then.
And I would say as a DM, you have to be prepared for this to be happening in your world. People will die, and you're going to have to figure out how you're going to deal with it.
You should have a world where that is at least a possibility. I think that's my greatest thing to work on. I almost see myself as too nice of a DM, where I see combat as story building than it is necessarily life-threatening. And that's something that I've definitely focused on in preparation for my next bout of being a DM. I want you guys to be afraid. But then if I achieve that, then there is the inevitable question of, okay, what are you going to do about it?
But, I mean, there are many ways to go around that. I mean, they could take over an NPC, a well-known NPC that you guys know, or they could roll up a character and somehow you run across them. It's not unlikely that you would run across someone. Or, in my world, I have set it up that the goddess of the dead is always willing to make bargains for those who have passed. In her neutrality. Because it's a way that she can touch the
material plane.
The material plane. For most reasons, she has to stay out of it. But when people die, she has an opportunity to make a bargain with them to do something.
Let's say I am fighter guy in your world, and I go in there and I'm in some combat, in some delve, and all of a sudden I come up on the Minotaur. We have a good combat, but all of a sudden, boom, he takes me down. I'm dead, and I'm facing...
Well, I have it...
Like, what would be a typical bargain?
Yeah,
or is it kind of character-based?
Well, the goddess of the dead is opposed to the goddess of the undead. The goddess of the undead is her daughter. And so the goddess of the dead will always make a bargain for you to oppose the undead. And that's...
Because they kind of have a grudge, these sisters. Or no, mother-daughter.
Well, yeah, because the daughter killed her father. So
her husband.
So, yeah. So that's why the goddess of the dead has this vendetta against her daughter. So there's always that ability to make a bargain. But because of that.
But what would be a bargain, though? I mean, just for someone that hasn't played in your world before, like, is a bargain. I guess the reason I'm asking it is that I see this as a measure for people to still be afraid of death.
Yes.
But allowing you as a DM to keep a player with his investment, i.e. his character.
Well, usually the
because when you have that alternate plan of like throwing them an NPC or giving them another character, all of a sudden you can't help but steal their investment away from them. This is character that they've spent so much time with the backstory or whatever, preparing, getting into so how many levels, how many sessions, and all of a sudden it's just ripped out from under them because of a bad dice roll or because of bad luck or whatever. You know, what's the trade-off?
It usually is, she will allow them to return, but in that return, of course, there's a debt that they need to repay.
And like a favor or?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, it's a favor. It's a debt. Obviously, a year.
So it's not like you return, but you have like a -2 to blah.
No. Usually it's like there's a debt that you need to pay. I don't really like to do those things where you're subtracting levels or something like that. It always makes things really screwy. But, you know, to repay this debt, like there's a particular undead creature that you must go against within a year's time or something like that, or you return to me.
So it works out for everyone's favor. They get their character back and you get a plot point that you can throw in.
Right.
At your choosing.
Yeah. And then usually that always will be said, the next time you're mine. There is no return.
This is a one-time deal. You have one green mushroom.
And then that's kind of the whole thing that it develops that stronger, that little bit of a paranoia in them to like, I got to make sure that I don't die. I cannot be as careless as I am. Because let me say one thing. Tobias is being careless. Very careless. Going on to that ship without preparing any kind of spells of protection against himself or us or anything is very, very careless. Violet was not careless. Violet has fly on. And I knew like Violet had fly for 7 minutes. And Violet knew it was like, well, for 7 minutes, I can be in the air within a heartbeat. And that was her main thing. You know, and the other thing is Violet also has invisibility quickly at her disposal. So if anything goes really bad, fuck it, I'm invisible. You know, and that's one of the things Tobias has a tendency never to prepare himself for. He is always just hopping onto things, thinking he's safe, but the man does not have the hit points to survive things. So, and
which makes me wonder, bringing it back to this particular instance of a DM being forced to react to a character death.
Yes.
And as we were talking about before, he had you be the favor giver.
Yeah.
Here's a character that's down. I need somebody to bring it back. You're here. You're there to do this. And as a consolation, he gave you this fourth level spell to use in your sorcerer cachet, as it were. But seeing how you are one to play a part in Kriya's interests, it would be interesting to see if this actually
draws me closer to
has ramifications outside of this specific solution.
It's kind of funny, but it didn't seem to be. He was resuscitated, brought back to the world. But and I think that's kind of something I missed in that. That really, it should be that Kriya should be a little pissed with him because he's being way too careless. She has a purpose for him, and he's not engaged in it.
It's maybe too soon to tell because it's only been this single session in wake of this experience. But I think either between you doing a good deed for Kriya and her champion, or this champion acting in a way that's not quite in line.
And because it was funny for...
Like, how far do the gods act with these mortals? Or how to what degree do the gods interact with these mortals?
And it was kind of a funny interaction because of the fact that it was not like there was a warning towards Tobias. It was just that I got a gift.
Yeah.
You know, which is great. I get a gift, but it's like the moral of this is particular thing is not really felt by Tobias.
It's been lost on those that were directly involved.
Right, right. You know, and so thinking about it, I think Wolfie felt a little bit like concerned that he brought a challenge level too high for us.
Which I think is something that a DM shouldn't be afraid of.
Well, and the thing is that, I mean, as a challenge level, I mean, was it really that high, too high for us? Not really.
Not really. We were really set up poorly.
Well, here are many things about what that I saw in that combat. One, we have this quarter orc who just refuses to use the bow. This is a long range combat.
We are on a specific
yeah.
P piece of land.
Yep.
It's out there away from our melee potential.
Yep. So it's
what are you going to do?
Get your bow out and shoot some arrows. Granted, I understand you can't do 55 hit points of damage to the creature, but get your arrows out and fire at it. Consider that some of the combat that we are going to be dealing with is going to be at range. To this point, Magnus...
Especially now that we're out on ships on islands.
Well, and to this point, Magnus has been very lucky that all of the combat really has truly been in...
Melee-centric.
In favor.
Yeah.
But really, it's going to start to slip away from that. There'll be a lot of times where Magnus is just standing there with his axe, just looking, going, boy, I really wish I could be useful in this combat. The focus has been so strong in tight hand-to-hand combat that there's been a total disregard to all range. I think that right there is something at 7th level should have been completely ignored. You have range potential, but you were underwater.
Yeah. I was basically taken out of this combat due to my positioning when it started.
Yeah, which is...
By the time I got above the surface of the water, it had done its inky black jet escape.
Yeah.
Ink cloud... Off it goes,
and
it suffered enough damage.
And really, honestly, Taro needs to get his butt on his owl and get in the air. Really, honestly, it's like, you need to get in the air. You need to get in the air.
And this almost strikes me as, like, all right, I'm going to try to reference a movie and not doing any spoilers, but anyone that's seen Avengers knows that the first big action, as you might guess, so I think I'm safe to, like, not spoil it for anyone that still hasn't seen the movie that has an interest to see it, but the first big comet they have, they're all kind of on their own. They don't really work as a party. They don't really work as a team, and they see the consequences of that. Yeah. And I think we had that experience too, where we all have great abilities, but we're all kind of in this unfamiliar territory. We're all kind of wondering how to act.
Yeah.
But nevertheless, how to work as a team.
Yeah.
And it all just kind of blows up in our faces. We survive, it runs away, but we didn't really win that combat.
No, we didn't. We didn't. I think we dealt enough damage to it that it split, or...
Or Wolfie, as the DM, decided, you know what? The longer I drag this out, the worse it's going to get. So let's just end it.
But, you know, it was funny, too, because at that point when I received a fourth level spell, one of the spells I was considering was Wall of Ice.
Mm-hmm.
And I would have put a wall of ice between us and the squid. And I think just a few rounds of us getting ourselves prepared for this combat.
Yeah, saying, okay, guys.
Let's get together.
We have 30 seconds or however long, to get our shit together.
Let's get our shit together.
And I come out of the water going,
wait a minute. No, you were a floater by that time.
Yeah, I was. I didn't hide successfully, and I got brought down.
Right, as Violet always wonders, just irritated every time she glares at you. Every time you go underwater, it's just like, what are you doing in the water?
Yeah.
It's the worst place for you to be.
I get brought back because I didn't go way under like Tobias did. I got resuscitated, and your first reaction was to bonk me on the head and go, stay out of the water!
Yeah, stay out of the water. Now, at this point, when everyone revived and staggering around, we decided to search the ship.
Mm-hmm.
Besides Magnus and Taro, who continue to persist to remain in the skiff,
right?
And, and it's like, yes, that's an interesting role playing thing, but you know what? It really sucks when you divide a group like that. And and that's kind of that thing where they don't understand. It's like, this ship has clues to it. We need to be on it.
Yeah,
we just don't leave it.
There's that balance in so many things in role playing games, where at least in this instance, it was like, okay, your character would do this, but you should, as a player, identify that this thing is put here for this reason.
Right.
For you to cling onto your character motivation and ignore this might not have the best compromise.
Right. I don't think it's very good role playing. There's times where you need to go with the flow with what's going on. I understand. But
even though it's not truly what your character would do.
Yeah. And the thing is I don't consider Magnus to be not brave. So I think Magnus would come. I don't think Magnus would jump in the boat.
This divide still happened, and I think there was a certain ripple effect or further ramifications as we got deeper into this little mini dev of this ship, because we ended up searching through the rooms, and there was, I guess in a nutshell, kind of a mess hall, a kitchen area, but bunks, and
it was really good because you were able to catch interest for Taro and the thing is like, but there might be treasure down there,
which
drew Taro out of the boat,
there was a little bit of a RPG/metagaming challenge where it's like, okay, we need to get this halfling to join us. Luckily, I had that chip to play.
Well,
we're all kind of making attempts, but then, once I thought, well, in the same way that you, Taro, wanted to cut Violet out of the booty from the last delve, where she turned into liquid and wasn't there, you know what? If you're going to stay on this boat, we're going to go in here and we're going to check stuff out. If we find anything valuable, guess who's not going to get cut into this?
Yeah.
you just like Violet didn't. And then, okay.
And, it, you know, I guess in a sense it's sort of interesting role play because we have to find ways to persuade these characters to come follow us.
Right.
I think it's good, but as long as it's not too often, to not always be going, I'm slitting in a different direction.
Right.
It's like, well, come on.
To say the B word again with balance.
Yeah.
You play your character, but then time is precious. Is it worth slowing it down? Yeah. I mean,
yeah.
Who's to know? I'm not saying it's always best to just move forward and ignore your character, because it's fun to get into those opportunities, and there were a good share of other opportunities as we got further into this boat. But, yeah, I don't know. I guess it just takes that outside perspective. This is what my character would do, but there's other people at the table.
Yeah. So we went down, and there are several rooms that definitely just, it was basically a description of a massacre. There were different rooms of a ship, but all the doors were trapped with explosive runes.
And the first one actually had a magic mouth response that was sort of a taunting threat in obvious elf form.
Right.
In the way that Wolfie has decided to portray elves in his world is with a sudden taunting French accent.
Yeah.
It was made apparent right off the get-go that the elves totally owned this ship, left it to sink, and those inhabitants to die, and then proceeded to put barriers on all the doors with these warnings of, like, fuck off. Yeah. But, you know, we know better than to do that.
Right. So, several different ways. I used Unseen Servant once to open a door. It took some damage and disappeared.
Or just tell Magnus to open it.
We had Magnus open it. We had Tobias open it. And Violet even opened one. She took a little damage, but it wasn't that bad.
Fire reduction?
It was force, so fire didn't help.
Oh, that's right.
There was a point where we were divided, and it was the gnomes in one place and all of the other non-gnome characters in a different area.
And I think this was a great moment that I didn't realize the potential until we were there.
Yeah.
On either end of the ship, we find ourselves in what seems to be the captain's chamber.
Yeah.
We've come upon this silver jar that must have been a plan B, plan C, backup whatever for the captain that he never got to use. Because on the silver jar, there was a skull and crossbones with an elf ear underneath it. And we deduce that it's elfbane.
You tasted it. And you recognize it was elfbane.
Yep. I recognize that it was elfbane, which, as it was spelt out by Wolfie, we were able to smear it on a weapon as a four-round action, and it lasts a few rounds. And it really does well to cut down the elves.
Yeah.
But, okay, the gnomes are in this room alone to their own devices with this object. Boddington immediately had this response, and he was glad that it was just Violet with him so that he could voice this concern to go, maybe we should keep this a secret.
Right.
Maybe everything we've come to know through human culture about the elves is a little bullshit. What if, I mean, this is not an unconventional Boddington reaction, just like with the leprechaun or shadow god that stole away the stardust or whatever. It's like, but still, seriously, what if it's not in our best interest to try to kill them? Sure, this would obviously help us. And if other people in our party, mainly Tobias, I'm guessing, got a hold of this and he comes upon else's first response is to use this and all of a sudden bloodshed and combat. Like, what if we could keep this as a backup plan, but try to interact with the elves in another way? What if they're not as bad as they seem just because humans hate them? They were the ones that started it, right?
Right. And, you know, and as you're telling Violet was agreeing to this. And it was really funny because Wolfie was painting a very, very clear picture that the elves really consider anybody, if they're not elf, to be somewhat of
the hostile
to what their cause is. But for Violet, and I think for you, it's like, we're gnomes. And it was kind of funny because it's like a really just, you know, because at that point you were saying this to me and I was like, well, you know, what would Violet consider this? So I went to the core book to read how gnomes view elves.
Or was it the Advanced Race Guide?
It was Advanced Race Guide, but we view them with respect.
Yeah.
I mean, they're magical creatures and they're fey.
Yeah.
And so are we.
Because even if we could beat them, wouldn't it be kind of tragic if we had this fight unnecessarily when we could have talked it through and kind of got to share some cool things about each other?
Yeah.
That would be so much better.
And the humans have kind of proven that they do some strange things that we don't fully understand, like sell evil things.
Right.
And Tarot's involved in that too.
Yeah.
They sold evil things, and I don't think both of us really understood why they did that.
It was a good correlation where the two of us missed that session where they did all that shit.
Yeah.
And you and I had that reaction of like, really? They sold this stuff?
And
but now we have the situation where the two of us are in this room together to kind of react to that.
Yeah. And we're looking at this stuff and I'm like, yeah, you're right. Maybe we shouldn't give this stuff.
And it motivated our kind of confiding in each other. Yeah. Like, okay, I'll keep this in my wagon. You know, I'll mark it like it's something insignificant because I don't know.
Yeah. We hid that from them and we continued on our way. And we went toward, I'm sorry. And we also found a little bit of map. They found that little chunk of lap map.
Yes.
That gave us a clue to one of the islands and a purpose on there that we could be doing. There were towers there, and if we used stardust and turned them towards each other, something would happen.
Yeah, it's like this little piece of tissue paper that's like 3 inches by 2 inches. And in Wolfie's classic microscopic handwriting, it says, set the powder, flame, then align the sights to north tower, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And it's obviously cut off, so like there's an obvious top half to this map that we don't have.
Right.
Or bottom half, if you decide to turn it the other way. Who knows?
But we had this clue.
Yeah. And after returning to our main ship and being able to rest and interact with the crew and trying to, you know, put them at ease despite all this danger and turmoil, even though I don't know why they're surprised, it's the floating isles. I mean, adventure.
Yeah.
Suck it up, humans. we kind of consulted our main map with this little fragment and kind of put pieces together and found our next island to move towards after a night of rest and perhaps shaking over a mild hangover from the night of increasing morale. With the crew.
Yeah. So we went to this next isle, and the isle was basically the shoreline was protected by trees that were growing in the water. So they had to park the boat and we had to swim in. So,
yep.
And I didn't do that. I flew.
And I decided to row while sitting on my wagon, which is the new and improved built wagon that is waterproof and floatable.
Yeah.
I think the only two that really had trouble were Tobias and Magnus, who actually had to get there the hard way.
Because Tara flew, which was good.
Tara flew, you flew, and I paddled. But we do get there, and as you and Tara atop George were kind of scouting aerially, you managed to notice that an island to the north suddenly disappeared. So here, the floating isles are kind of doing the sporadic shit that we had heard about and were warned against. Luckily, it wasn't this island, but still, it's happening.
Yeah.
We get another map drawn out for us from Wolfgang based on your scouting. It is, if you just imagine, kind of a figure eight shaped island with a north tower and a south tower, a sort of calibration and a coordination between these two towers. We don't know exactly which one is which or how it exactly should work, or at least Boddington did. I don't know. Did you know anything more about that?
No, not really. No.
So we decided to go for one because that's a perfectly good way to start.
Right.
And before long, we come upon a wall.
Yes.
Like a fortified wall with a portcullis and an obvious intent to keep us on the side we're on.
Yeah.
And not going further.
Violet went over and casted Spider Climb on Magnus. Being Magnus is the strongest, I thought Magnus could just haul us all over the wall.
Yep.
Why waste our time? Taro, still being able to fly, having 4 hours to fly, just flew over the wall and was scouting around on the other side. She took me up to the top of the tower, no problem.
I thought it would be beneficial to the whole party if I just climbed up it under my own power, and I thought the best or the easiest surface to climb up was the gate in front of us.
Yeah.
So I go to touch that.
Well, you started to climb it.
And I was immediately posed with a reflex save because this became white hot. That wasn't the way to go.
Yep. So what we see is, and we see carved in each one on the wall at the top, there were stone carvings of creatures, large creatures that looked a lot like the giant orc predecessors to the orcs that roamed the land at the same time as the Lost. And the reason that he brought up the wispy creatures from the plane of shadow is that they are also the same tall orcish, handsome orcish creatures.
The same proportion.
Yeah. So it was just kind of a reminder back to the Lost, basically.
We are stumbling upon some ancient shit.
Right. Yes. So I was up there looking at that. You, I think Magnus went down there and grabbed you next.
Yeah, because I can't do it alone.
Yeah. Oh, well, I think you got really, really wounded and someone had to heal you.
No, I've definitely fallen in the strategy of using my extract called Alchemical Allocation. Which allows me to drink a prepared potion I have, where I drink this extract, I drink the potion, I spit the potion back out, I get the benefits from the potion, and it still maintains. So that's a second level extract, and I've kind of used the majority of my second level extracts just for that, because I've tried to increase my arsenal of potions available, and with this alchemical extract, it basically gives me the freedom to choose what extract I would use in the same sense that a sorcerer would, because I have more potions extracts that I can prepare. More often than not, I'd be using one of my alchemical allocations, drinking my Cure Serious Wounds potion, spitting it back out, going on, because I was definitely suffering a significant amount of damage off and on throughout this whole session.
Right. So,
with Tobias's help, but still, I needed to kind of help myself out, too.
On the way back down, then, Magnus dropped a rope for Tobias to climb up. Tobias got up a certain level and completely failed and fell.
I think, and what better time to start initiative?
Yeah, and well, I think the whole thing was is that I think at that point he was yelling at us and it's just like, open the gate, you know, because he was just angry about the whole thing. So you went and touched a door.
Yes. And so if you imagine painting the scene here, Tobias is flat on his ass on the ground in front of this wall. I'm up on the wall and it's kind of one of these like typical guards along the wall. There's this walkway going along. And as you walk closer to where the gate is, there's a door leading into this tower that presumably there's the way to get the gate to open within that tower space. So I'm up there. Magnus is up there. Are you up there? Or are you flying around still?
No, I'm up there. I didn't have fly on.
All right. So the three of us are up there. George and Tara are still flying around. Yes. I hear Tobias yell frustratedly. And so I go for that door.
Yeah.
And upon touching that door is what seems to have conjured up the guardians.
Well, from all those carved statues or carved shapes in the wall, these basically large metallic golems appear.
With jawlines similar to Magnus,
yes,
as it was portrayed.
Right.
So spaced across this wall, there was, what, five? Yep.
So Violet rolled actually the highest, which was unusual, but very lucky.
Yes.
So I just ran right off the wall. Because I have Featherfall, I just ran right off the wall.
And Wolfie divulges a certain amount of combat metagaming information by the one closest to you, sees you jump off the wall and goes to swing, but then checks a swing once he realizes that you are no longer a threat to invading what he is set to guard.
And the whole reason that Violet was leaving the area is to go get Tobias.
Mm-hmm.
She could cast Spider Climb on him and get him up there because Tobias needed to be up there to help us.
Yep.
Because she knew we were in super trouble. So this was another combat that we were not fully prepared for.
And we're kind of all acting under our own free individual will.
Yeah.
And I'm still focused on getting into this tower area and getting somehow to open up this gate. But as my progress is going round for round, more and more people are realizing this checked swing thing and jumping off the wall and getting out, but on the side that we previously came from. So I'm still holding to my guns. I'm still sticking to my guns because I'm hoping for this great heroic moment for Boddington where everyone jumps on the side of the wall where they came from, realizing that, shit, we're alive, but we haven't gotten to the tower we need to because we're still on this side of the wall. How are we going to get across? Wait, where's Boddington? And then at that moment, I heroically open up the gate. At least that was my goal. But as we're all dealing with these guardians along the wall, I hop into this tower area, and it's described that there's a ladder going down, and there's this room, and there's another door on the opposite side. And one of the guardians hops in after me. So I immediately try to go down the ladder, start to go down the ladder. It follows me. I'm able to then get back up the ladder because I had only started.
You were going to go down the ladder because you were going to go to the lower level because there was nothing truly on this level.
Yeah.
You were going to go down because you figured that the gear or lever to lift the gate was on the lower level.
Mm-hmm.
You had just gotten to the ladder.
At the top.
Yeah. And then the golem, he just slid down the ladder and was right above you so that you could hop off the ladder.
I recognized its orcish physical qualities, even even though I heard their dialect and it was kind of different from the orc that I'm used to, because I know orc is a language. So I, in the simplest sort of orc I can project, I yell to him, and it seems to give it pause enough for me to at least exhibit that tendency. But then, yeah, once I get back up the ladder, realize there's a door, that was kind of the big hope moment, because, I mean, this is all from Boddington's point of view, round for round, that other things are going on, and as it's kind of the meantime in between, I'm sitting there just totally investing, and I just need to get to this door. I need to get in there, and I could release the gate. All would be well. But again, in very similar to the whole giant squid combat, suddenly combat is put upon us. Boddington, at least, was forced to act before being able to take advantage of all his alchemical potential, his mutagens, his extracts, everything else.
And that little, and it would be good to point out that the other door that's across on this level that you were on was a small access panel.
Yeah.
And that's what it was. It wasn't really a door. It was an access panel. And so you were there, you were going to go open it.
It was like the mouse hole and I'm being chased by the cat.
Right. But at the same time, Magnus is out there fighting and Magnus got hit really hard. I mean, Magnus is sticking in that fight and is actually doing some decent damage to it. Because truly, this is the kind of combat that Magnus is prepared for.
Mm-hmm.
But 4 golems is too much. That's just too much for anybody. And
especially considering this sort of terrain where it's 10 feet wide and just long.
Yeah.
And these golems, these guardian orc creatures, whatever you want to perceive them as, they're 10-foot characters. So they take up 10 feet by 10 feet space.
Yeah.
So it's very linear. There's no freedom of movement in this. And I think we kind of were asking for that. But it's an advantage and disadvantage to both parties.
And, you know, Magnus was flanked. But still, Magnus had spider climb. Now, Taro was hovering on George. But these guards also had the ability to shoot arrows.
Yes.
They started shooting arrows at George, and George was taking a lot of hits. So George took pretty much like a full round of hits, because these are golems, they can hit on a dime.
Mm-hmm.
There's no getting away from them on that.
They are designed to defend, to keep invaders from getting beyond them.
Yeah.
And they are exhibiting that potential very well.
Tobias summoned a lantern, Archon lantern. The Archon lantern started shooting rays of light at these creatures. Not a lot of damage, but it was a bit of damage.
Yeah, was helpful. And it was a pretty effect that kind of seemed to take that whole spiritual weapon to the next level.
Yeah, and he,
from what we've seen, anyway.
Well, and he brought spiritual weapon out too.
So
he was doing his best to get some damage on him, but the armor class was high.
This whole encounter kind of seemed to be not so much here you are in encounter that you have to kill these guys and move forward. It was like these guys are out to kill you because you messed up.
Yeah,
it didn't seem to be designed for us to beat them.
No. But for Violet, she casted Fly again. She flew up, fired a lightning bolt at him, damaged him somewhat, but I don't know how much damage I did. And
the whole time we weren't able to get any sort of impression that we were
honestly, I didn't shoot lightning bolt at him. I shot magic missiles because I didn't know what would restore their health.
Yeah.
Then they started to turn their attention towards Violet, but Violet, being Violet,
Has invisibility. Yeah.
She has invisibility to make sure that she was not in the scene anymore.
And that was right about the time where I'm having this highly anticipated moment of hopeful heroism, where it's me and this guy, and he's coming after me, charging through like Frodo and the cave troll, and he's trying to weasel his way in. And it came down to this single round where I made my acrobatics roll to get out of its threatened square to get into that space, and then it came its turn to attack me, and it was seriously a matter of single digits. So it was like one or two he was able to hit me, and one or two by the amount of damage he did to bring me back under zero once again.
Mm-hmm.
I thought, A, it was thrilling to have that potential, and B, it was very interesting to see that I was that close without any sort of alchemical buffing.
Right.
Because, like I was saying, we were thrown into this, and Boddington was left to react right off the get-go, and he was immediately thrown into action, because when initiative is rolled, unless I'm, you know, up on the hillside behind stuff and safe, when there's bad guys around me, I'm not gonna really, my first instinct isn't going to be to drink buffer potions. I'm going to, you know, if somebody comes up to you and starts charging at you and swinging stuff at you, you're going to try to get out of the way or do something knee-jerk response.
Yeah.
Not go, drink a potion to bonus this, you don't.
Yeah.
So it was a close call, but I fell again. And I think that's where it lined up with you being invisible and flying around and Magnus having the spider climb, being concerned about me at that point.
Well, and Tobias, I did cast spider climb on Tobias as well. And Tobias, he climbed up the wall
mm-hmm.
and he casted the sonic
boom.
Yeah, but it's not Sonic Boom. It's Soundburst.
Soundburst.
Yeah. So he casted Soundburst, and surprisingly, because we recognized earlier that Magnus did a critical hit on it, it doesn't matter. These are constructs. They have no organs. But the sonic resonance going through them, that does have the ability to stun them. And as Steve pointed out, that is... very few creatures have the ability to avoid that sonic
right. Many creatures have elemental resistances, but sonic is kind of a universal, like, all things susceptible. Yeah.
And so it was really
unless
neat.
You're deaf.
And it was really neat to see one of them was stunned by that.
Yeah.
Which was great. So, I mean, it was a very cool spell.
So, we did have our moments, but still, I mean, bottom line.
Well, and also, although... it was Taro's intention to get out of that fight in the next round. George took a lot of more hits from arrows, and down they went. Taro got a little too hot-headed about it, I do believe, because Taro was like, they shot George. I'm going to keep shooting arrows at these things. And it's like, when Violet got up there, it's like, Taro, go. George, get out of there. You're not prepared for this combat. No, none of us were prepared for this combat.
We've been very ambitious, but very sloppy.
Yeah.
This whole session.
And so Taro went down on George, and poor George got very close to death. Very, very, very close. Like, Taro should have died. I really think so. I don't even know how close he was there, but Taro was able to force potions down the Solid's throat and revive him a little bit, but not out of the unconscious state. I think it took several potions to just revive it, because all the potions he has are all Cure Light. And you were able, Magnus, caring deeply about you, went after you and climbed through a window to get to you and...
Right, and not to, like, totally ignore the initial threat. This golem, whatever you want to call it, orc creature that was swinging at me and striking at me, brought me down. It looked at me, saw that I was neutralized, and then went back out to the wall.
Yes.
So here I am down in this room by myself. So that Magnus was able to kind of sneak in and revive me.
Mm-hmm. Being invisible, Violet was able to hover past these creatures that were on guard. I think they were looking for me, but I turned invisible.
They are all sitting there with readied actions, with their ranged weapons against any potential invaders. And there you were, right in front of one, and it still remained there with its readied actions. Right. So I was happy to see that happen.
So, and then down to the lower level, I did find the lever and opened the lever, and that neutralized all the golems. They returned to their... spots on the wall.
Yes.
But I think we did learn a lot in this particular combat.
Or this particular session. It was kind of a humbling session where we're sitting there asking for a bunch, and here we got it.
Well, me and you talked at great length afterwards, and you were saying that Bonding's beginning to recognize that Violet is sort of a tactician. That Violet always sort of has, like, a particular kind of combat plan. You know, it was like, if I'm in combat, I can avoid combat by turning invisible or getting out of it and so forth.
Well, Violet is a character, as Boddington sees it, as one that has a lot of ideas. All of her ideas are good ideas. Not ideas that Boddington would ever think of, but there's kind of been a turning of the page from the way that Boddington sees Violet. Whereas in the initial levels in our adventures in the past, it's been like more kind of getting out there adventuring and having fun. Hanging from planar models or sliding across seemingly shallow pools. And the consequences come along, but we get through them, it's fine. But here's something where, as I was kind of initially playing into these aisles, is like, this is something more severe. And now that this level of severity is kind of coming more and more true, I'm suddenly taking to listening to all these ideas and points of view that you have. Because I initially just thought that to be kind of like, okay, book smarts, sure, whatever, let's have fun. And now I realize that all your blabbering is very consistent and very true and very accurate. I'm just finding myself gravitating towards that more.
Yeah. The thing, just going into this next, our next session, I really am looking to help Taro out, because Taro really keeps on putting George at danger. Way too close to combat. Way too close. And he has the ability to be really, really far away from it.
And I'll back you up on that, because I don't even know what you're going to say, but with my initial camaraderie with Magnus and buddy buddies, it's like, that's there for camaraderie's sake, but we need you for the insight that'll allow us to survive.
Yeah. And I just really want to make some kind of bond with this unfortunate character who is very much an outsider.
This halfling.
The halfling, and the halfling needs to be more involved in the group. Mm-hmm. And there's got to be some olive branch to pull us together, because it really can't have more and more of this where we're divided.
Yeah, because we'll just have more and more initiative roles where we're at a total disadvantage.
Right. I mean, I think the whole thing is, when we first started off, it was very, the reason that, you know, Violet was able to bond with Tobias is a human, so he's bigger than her. When problems come along, she would be close to the human so that she could duck behind the human. But that is becoming kind of like, I don't need to duck behind the human
anymore. I can fly now.
I can fly. I can turn invisible. Yeah. I can get away. Now the human's becoming to be a little bit more like
a liability.
A liability. You're right, right. But at the same time, Tobias has a lot of great spells. And I think Violet recognizes there's a lot of really good spells that Tobias has.
Yeah.
Bless and all those things give us bonuses, gives us protection, helps us out. But we're not really preparing ourselves for these combats.
Yeah.
And that's kind of where I think we need to get to the point where we're like, okay, you know, we need to figure out how to.
Especially getting to our third session with these floating isles. And it's kind of like, we're being tested here. Mm-hmm. We need to be on our A game.
I know that, like, going into the next level, one of the first spells that she's going to pick up is clairvoyance. That ability to scry, because we don't have that really in our arsenal. Mm-hmm. None of us can truly scry into things and see what's going on.
Us some insight that would allow us to prepare for something,
right?
Short of just jumping in and going, "Hey,
yeah." And, you know, and the thing is, it was really funny because I remember when, like, you were swimming and you went underneath the water, and what you'd like right away, it was like, it's murky and dark. If only you would have casted dancing lights, you mm-hmm. could have illuminated all that territory, and we could have actually expanded the mala to be able to see everything outside of our range, but we didn't.
Right.
We didn't think through that. So it's kind of funny that it's like, oh yeah, we just need to get, we're at this point where it's all of a sudden, well, we need to get a little smarter.
Yeah. We have, like we were bragging about in past sessions, about this sudden spike of potential. Now the DM is meeting us halfway.
Right.
And giving us a challenge to match us that our mere abilities won't save us.
Yeah.
We need to be able to harness them. It's like that whole Kung Fu, you have these abilities, but can you use them wisely?
Well, our individual abilities cannot protect us.
Yes.
Against such creatures. It was a squid. It was just one. But that squid really had all its advantages.
Yep.
It was in water. It could reach out and touch us. And we couldn't really get to it. It had a lot of
And the guardians on the wall had an advantage there. Yep. Because we were just sitting ducks.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's brought it back to our court now. Where, sure, we leave this session off with an open gate, able to move forward. Is the gate open?
The gate is open.
Okay. Yeah.
Violet went down and opened it up, and that's what neutralized the...
So, you know, I think maybe we got to have a little team huddle before we actually approach this first tower.
I think
whatever it is in store.
Yeah.
We saw what didn't work, and we have the ability to learn from that and to make it work. You know, I guess the pendulum swings between players and DMs one-upping the other.
Yeah.
We definitely were humbled in this one, but hey.
And it's good. It's good. It's good to be humbled. Like, Wolfie is presenting these islands as dangerous.
Yep. And he's bringing it.
So that's nice to see.
Yeah.
All right. So, I don't know, with that said,
we hope to survive to tell you about further experiences.
Exactly.
I'm Jake.
And I'm Mako.
And this has been RPG Afterglow.
Awesome.
See you. And rpgafterglow@gmail.com.
Yes, sir.
Is an email address that you should put into your to form and just write anything and click send.
Yeah.
Yeah.